Must have driven this poor thing in first gear at 6,000 revs just to show off and hear the sound of the engine. And I thought, hey, that is the coolest car in the world. And so many years later, I finally saved up enough money.
His uncle was one of the legendary Bentley boys. He stands as one of the most important collector car dealers on this planet. He has personally brokered the sale of the world's most expensive motor car. He is one of the impactful forces in modern car culture, a man whose passion and expertise contributed directly to the rise of the Lamborghini Miura and the McLaren F1. He keeps car culture alive as a publisher of books and cinematic films. He is the official voice of the most elite Concours events. One of them is the Concorso d'Eleganza Villa d'Este, a true multilingual cosmopolitan who rarely says no to a well-mixed Negroni. If there is a real version of James Bond in the automotive universe, it is absolutely him. Please welcome to the Classic Driver Talks, the one and only Simon Kidston. How do you like that intro?
My head is not going to fit out of this room afterwards. Thank you very much. I'm wondering who you're talking about. Yeah.
It's absolutely you, Simon, and we all know that. Thank you very much for spending time with us, because we know your schedule is like super full. So we really appreciate that you join us.
When Classic Driver comes calling, who could say no?
That's very kind of you to say. Simon, I would like to start a little bit with the family history, because if you look at your father and your uncle and other family members, cars have been played a very important role. So naturally, someone like you as son or nephew needed to go also the car path. Is that kind of right to say?
Not at all. not in the slightest. I would say, but thanks for suggesting it. I would say that cars in my family always played a secondary role, second to basically work,
yeah.
Because cars were always a hobby. And work consisted mainly of either being in the Navy or the Army or farming. And a long time before that, I suppose you'd call it industry. It was shipping up in Scotland. Cars were always just a hobby. For my grandfather, over 100 years ago, at the beginning of the last century, who loved his cars, he was a captain in the Black Watch, the Scottish Regiment. My uncle, who raced Bugattis, Bentleys, amongst other, but he was a lieutenant commander in the Navy.
Yeah.
And my dad, who was also a lieutenant commander in the Navy, but in the Second World War, and then a farmer. But nobody in my family ever worked in cars. Nobody in my family, I suspect, ever made a single penny by selling a car.
Yeah.
You bought it, you enjoyed it, you sold it, you lost money. But I was the generation that had to earn a living. And somehow, I would say by accident, I managed to turn a passion for cars into a job.
Yeah.
Whether that's a respectable job or not, I don't know, my forebears are no longer around to give an opinion, but I think it's great if you can turn something which you love, a passion, into a career, into a vocation.
Yeah.
And I was just incredibly lucky to be able to do so.
I think that this step out of the atmosphere of this as a hobby to enjoy and driving and racing, make this a profession, is something, even if you're the first one in the family, I'm quite sure they would be quite proud of you. I'm very convinced.
I think my dad, who's no longer around, would just be happy that I actually had a job. because my beginnings were not terribly promising.
Yeah. What is your earliest automotive memory, though? So what is the one thing that really stuck to your memory that you will not forget in connection with cars?
The click of the door handle of the Porsche 911 when it was opened for a special trip, because that was a car that was considered a car for not just for going shopping, yeah, but for special occasions. And as a small kid, hearing that sound, it's very distinctive. You know, it hasn't changed that much in Porsche 911s over the years. The door opening, the smell of the interior, and I still have that car, and it still smells the same all these years later.
Yeah,
I think it's a mixture of cheap German materials and the glue that holds them together, and the whine of the fuel injection as the ignition key turns, and then obviously the bark of the engine when it fires up. And I, of course, in those days would sit in the back of that car, which is not a very spacious place. But you always felt the adrenaline rise and the excitement going out in that car. So that is my earliest memory, along with very long trips and frequent trips in the back of the BMW 3-litre SI saloon, which we used to drive from England to Italy. It took 3 days.
Yeah.
Seemed to always take forever. When are we getting there? Punctuated by French hotels with no air conditioning and strange pillows and croissants that felt very foreign. Yeah.
Because you, with all the British connection, you, technically speaking, grew up in Italy, is it fair to say?
Yeah, I did, from the age of 8.
It was in Siena, is it right?
It was on a very remote farm outside of Siena. Yeah. And the nearest house was a kilometre away. This was a... and it wasn't fancy, by the way. Yeah. It was, and this was become before Chianti Shire became fashionable. It was hot. There were mosquitoes, no air conditioning, black and white TV, which only received local TV stations, which is how I learned Italian. You didn't get foreign papers. You didn't get foreign TV. Obviously, the internet hadn't been invented. So it was a very remote upbringing. And car magazines as a kid were a way of discovering a whole different and glamorous world.
And for this, was this maybe also the starting point for your love affair with a very special car built in Santa Agata Bolognese?
That came a little bit later. I would say that as a kid, like most people of my age, the Countach was the poster car. I remember the Observer's Book of Automobiles, this little hardback book that used to get published every year about... A bit like top trumps for cars.
Yeah.
The speed, the cost, the power, the engine size. Cadillac was always the biggest.
Yes, true.
That's a love affair I don't mention much. but the Countach was something from another planet. But I'd never seen any Lamborghini. You know, you didn't see those cars on the road. Certainly not in rural England, and not in rural Italy. So that was the car that you would read everything about when a magazine, the Motor was the magazine my dad used to get. And you get these group tests. It would be the Countach against a Ferrari Boxer, against an Aston V8 Vantage, against the Porsche 911 Turbo. And you'd study the figures, memorize them, and you just look at the styling and think, imagine if I could... You wouldn't even imagine driving a car like that. You'd think of being a passenger in a car like that. And I remember all those long trips in the back of the BMW, looking out of the window, wondering if one would ever drive past, and of course it never did. The Miura, I only discovered thanks to the Italian Job, the film, which I never saw when it came out. Mm-hmm. I was too young. But later on at boarding school in Switzerland, they had a VHS player, which I'd never seen before, and they put this film on, the Italian Job, and I thought, hey, I recognize that road. That's the road that my dad takes me to school in at the beginning of term, not in a Miura. And then there's this cool guy driving it with the cigarette and the sunglasses and the music. And I thought, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then you read more. I remember Supercar Classics, the English magazine, did features on Miuras. And again, I would read every word and imagine what it must be like. But I didn't actually see one until I started in the car business, age 21. And when one finally arrived in the showroom where I worked, I would come in early to look at it. I would stay late. I would ask if I could clean it. And then one day, and I never did get to drive that, but one day, a few months later, a Miura SV showed up, a white one with a blue interior. And I remember it had been delivered new to Malta, unusual mm-hmm. place to have a 170 yes. mile an hour supercar.
I would say so.
And it had the owner's crests, the first owner's crests on the doors. And it was delivered new to a big property guy there, who also had a Countach later. And I begged my boss, if it needs to be delivered somewhere to storage, could I please drive it? So eventually one of my colleagues said to me, I've been asked to deliver that car. I know you really want to drive it. You deliver it.
Nice.
I took the longest route ever from Kensington to our storage, stopped off to see friends around London. And I remember, I must have driven this poor thing in first gear at 6,000 yeah. revs just to show off and hear the sound of the engine. And I thought, hey, that is the coolest car in the world. And so many years later, I finally saved up enough money to buy a basic Miura
yep.
and started looking. I mean, I couldn't really afford it. I didn't even have a home.
Priorities, Simon.
Priorities.
It's all about priorities.
And then you think, well, you know, if I spent a little bit more, I could get an S. But then a cheap SV was available because it had been crashed, repaired, but crashed back in the 70s. And so God knows how, but I managed to buy that. It was a friend of a friend who owned it. And although my first drive in it, it tried to catch fire. I booked a nice hotel for the weekend for my new wife and I. And basically, she sat having dinner inside, and I was outside in the rain with the man from the AA breakdown service trying to identify where the smoke was coming from.
Yeah.
but yeah, that was exactly 30 years ago, and it's a love affair that hasn't ended, despite many adventures along the way. But yeah, if you ask me what my single, I guess, all-round favorite car is, despite all the other exciting things that I've been lucky enough to drive or to handle, there's always going to be a special place in my heart for a Miura.
What makes the Miura so special? What is this magical thing about it? Let's take the film away. What? Because
it's a time capsule.
Mm.
It's a time capsule of late 60s and early 70s Italy. I mentioned the Porsche RS before.
Yeah.
A Miura it's a snapshot of the post-war Italian economic miracle,
mm-hmm.
the style, the exuberance, the gioia di vivere, the joie de vivre, the joy of life that goes with that, the devil may care attitude. If it looks that good, does it need to be reliable?
Yeah.
It's low, it's sexy, it's voluptuous. The mechanics are impossibly exotic, far more horsepower and speed than you would need for any practical purpose. It's relatively hot inside. It's very noisy inside. Your luggage gets cooked, but every drive is an experience. And when you sit in it, you smell it. People don't talk enough about the smell of cars. Mm. It's like a pre-war Bugatti and the smell yeah. of the smell of the oil. The smell of it, it just takes you back to another place. That's what makes it special. When you get in that car, you're no longer in the reality of the modern world. You're in a distant place which somehow seems more carefree, more romantic, and just cooler.
Despite the fact that you had a Miura as in a stage where we said we could not really afford it, but you want to have it, and you
not
got
sure
it.
Not sure I can still afford it.
Yeah. I mean, nowadays, maybe it's even more difficult in a sense. But we come to the market situation a bit later.
Not too much market talk, please.
Not too much, but it's also interesting to see your point of view on some points. So and that's something that we will touch in a very elegant way, definitely. No, but what would be the way you have spec'd your Miura going down? Is Lamborghini in Kensington? Was it that time?
Back in those days, it was not in Kensington. It was in a place called Ailey Street in London.
Okay.
Nowadays, it's South Kensington.
So, despite the fact you had your Miura, I would like to understand what would be the spec, how would you have ordered a mirror back in London in the time when it was new? What would be the perfect model and the perfect spec for you?
That's a good question, which nobody has ever asked me before. And I have to admit, I'm not sure that I've ever thought of before.
I'm here at your service, Simon.
Obviously, the market, coming back to your earlier point, favors the SV. But there's a lot to be said for the P400 and the S, just because they have more 60s Barbarella, swinging 60s, Carnaby Street vibe to them. The eyelashes, the skinny wheels, and so on. I think I'm going to say that if it was a P400, it depends on the year. So let's say we're in 1967, the Austin Powers era, right? It would have to be, it's going to have to be lime green, isn't it? With a beige interior and...
Corresponding color down, would it be?
It was going to have silver sills and silver wheels. It's going to have a beige. It's going to have a beige vinyl interior. Cheap, hot, uncomfortable.
Of course,
but it's the way it should be.
Yeah.
If it's a
for many a marriage is like that.
Let's not go there. If it's a Miura S, and let's say it's a late Miura S.
Yeah.
We're getting into the 70s. I'm probably going to say it's going to be gold.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cool color.
Yes.
And it's again going to have a lighter interior, probably a tobacco interior. We might go for leather because that was then available. And it's going to have gold sills.
Yes.
That would look pretty funky.
Yeah.
And then if it was an SV, if I could have any spec... I'm probably going to go, although it wasn't a catalog model, for an SVJ, louder, badder, even less practical, makes a lot of noise. And I'm going to say, you see, here, of course, you've got a, here you've got a dilemma, because what was typical in the period isn't always what's fashionable now.
Sure.
You know, now everything gets ordered in green because it's a cool color, but very few. And I mean, sort of British racing green is, as you know, what is it? Oak green for Porsches?
Of course.
And I guess somebody today going back to 73 would probably order something like that. But I'm going to say, it's probably self-serving, but I'm going to say black, like my SV, with a white leather interior. About as decadent as it gets.
That's would also fit very much the number plate of your Rolls Royce.
Yes, it probably would.
And for those who don't know that, it says on your Rolls Royce, which you is like your daily driver in the UK, also you do it for transcontinental travels, do you?
No, car stays in the UK.
Okay.
But it is my daily driver, and I probably do maybe 10,000 miles a year with it, so quite a lot. I drove it up to Liverpool from London in the snow for lunch and back to have lunch with a good client.
Number plate.
FU2.
Yes. We can't repeat what it says here because otherwise we got on the blacklist of that podcast. But you can imagine what
it
could be.
I like it because it's, hopefully I'm not a rude person, but I like it because it's irreverent.
Yes.
It has a sense of humor. Yeah,
totally.
It is quite Austin Powers.
Yeah, it is
and
very
And as
Austin
you
Powers.
May know, that license plate, which was issued a long time ago, before it had its modern connotations, was on a Mini back in the 60s.
Which is also hilarious.
Yeah. And then it was on a V12 E-type Roadster, which was owned by the girlfriend of an adult entertainment baron who owned half of Soho. So it was a well-known license plate around town back in the day. And I liked the historical side to it. And even now, when you drive around London, sometimes a cabbie in traffic will wind down his window and say, "Oh, I remember that plate. Yeah, I remember when that was on an E-type." I think plates that mean nothing.
Yeah, they have
trying a bit hard.
So it's hard if you only have numbers, like in Switzerland, where you only can play with numbers. I mean, you have to be super creative. But I think the most creative country in the meaning of having a coded number place is the UK.
Yeah.
Look, so a 7 becomes a letter, or a 3 but becomes a letter.
If you have to think too hard to figure out what it is,
yeah, that's dangerous.
Then it's a bit,
yeah, that's a bit overthinking.
Then it's trying too hard.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the specs of your cars. I think the SVJ would go for me in the brown as well.
Yes, it would, definitely.
That would be something that I would love.
But brown would look great. Brown SVs look fantastic.
Yeah. So I think it's a lovely spec you had, and I like the bold statement of black and white leather.
Well, my SV has been in those colors since new. It was ordered in those colors by a 21-year-old whose dad said to him, look, if you sell that motorbike, what I think it was a Suzuki, a large displacement motorbike, I'll buy you any car you want. Now,
good deal.
Quite how the 21-year-old had such a motorbike, unless his dad had bought it for him in the first place, I'm not entirely sure. But his dad said, I'll buy you any car you want. And being 21, he thought, oh, I'll have a Lamborghini.
Yeah.
And his father, who was Mr. Innocenti, who made cars, mm-hmm. knew Ferruccio Lamborghini, called him up, went to see him with the son, and ordered this car.
But made it the Italian way. I make a call. We cut out everyone in between. We go directly.
I still have the order form.
Nice.
With all of these handwritten notes, all the special spec, outside filler, rivets, chromed bumpers, and more powerful engine.
Yeah.
How it was more powerful, he didn't specify. Yeah.
But
it was probably more powerful just because he wrote it on
exactly.
the form.
I think it's written, it's on paper, so it's
therefore
true.
Therefore, it must be true.
Yeah, absolutely. You know the stories about your cars very well. I mean, we touched only on two for now, but already it's really like, it's absolutely lovely to hear that it's not just a car, it's not just an investment, it's a story behind the car. How important is that fact for you? And please see it from both sides, also on your professional side. How does it really help to gain interest if a car tells a good story? Is this entertaining for the clients you have, or do they just go for that car, that model, that specification?
If you have two identical cars and one was delivered to somebody famous, or of course won a famous race, and the other one did nothing, then you're going to go for the car with the more interesting history.
Yeah.
When your friends come around to your home and see the car in the garage, it's more interesting if you can tell them something about it that is relatable, especially if they're not car people.
Yeah.
They may not be interested in how many horsepower it has, or whether it's got four-wheel drive or other technical geek facts. But if it was owned by Elvis or Steve McQueen or Juan Le Mans.
I agree. That's super special.
But even if it was owned by a more normal person, but something interesting, and I mean interesting good, not that ended up at the bottom of a lake, happened. Actually, even the lake with the Bugatti.
The Bugatti was also like text avoiding.
Sometimes a negative can be turned into a positive.
Absolutely.
That was a nice human story, the Bugatti at the bottom of the lake, but maybe we'll come to that later.
Yeah.
I've always said cars are about people. Cars bring people together in our modern world. That's why we're here today.
It's true, absolutely.
Shared passion for this subject. Cars were not made by themselves. They were made by people. I've said it many times before. They were designed by people, built, bought, raced, restored, and now looked after by people. It's the human stories, and that's what I like to focus on at Villa d'Este, that bring cars to life. Otherwise, they are just inanimate objects. And I think anybody who's in this world loves discovering the backstory to something.
Absolutely.
In an ideal world, getting to know the people, if you can track them down, meeting them, seeing their reaction when they're reunited with a car that they remembered from their youth that reminds them of a period in their life that's perhaps long gone. The human stories are what give cars depth. And to me, something that I might own personally should have an interesting story. It means something to me.
Mm.
Whether it has a bearing on the value or not is, to me, secondary. But it should have more than just two dimensions. It should have three dimensions. And that third dimension is the history. And that's what I try to find out when preparing for Villa d'Este and for the commentary over 2 days, to find the stories that perhaps haven't been found before. And that's what takes the time.
Yes.
That even the owners may not know, or they may know and not think are interesting, and to flesh those out. And that's why I talk too long, a bit like now.
Yeah, that's okay. It's a podcast.
Because
it's about talking.
It takes time to find those stories. And it's not just, by the way, at Villa d'Este, it's not just me doing that work. I have a colleague in particular, Steve Wakefield, who you know well.
A former classic driver manager.
He came from the Wright School.
Yes.
And Steve and I and others spend a lot of time doing that research, and it's what distinguishes one car from another.
This research is something that is also the most entertaining factor. So you see me browsing in the morning through the classic driver market. So this is what I do, and I'm seeing which new cars came in. Not that I can afford them, but you find like hilariously stories in the descriptions. And I have to say that
some of them might even be true.
Very rare, but they might be. And if they're not true, they're very well told. So I think that's also okay.
That's AI for you.
you know your trade better than anyone else and your colleagues in there. No, joking apart. So if I'm browsing through the classic driver market and I see a car that interests me, it could be a Range Rover, could be a 2.7 RS or whatever. And then reading the stories behind that, whether true or not, or hearsay, whatever it is, makes it... Also, the listing makes it special. And that's also what your colleagues do very well. They really like put in the whole history. And hilariously, the most entertaining one are those of our private sellers. So individuals that don't use the trade, they just say, okay, I have one car for sale. I do it on my own. Could also be very special. I remember one Alvis was for sale. And he said, I might be produced on the backseat of that car, saying in that listing.
He shouldn't be selling it.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, you're very well connected to the car. So this is why I can encourage everyone, if you feel bored and you want to find some funny, entertaining stuff, you can go to the Ettore of Classic Driver, but you can also browse through the market and read the description of the cars, because you find hilarious stories. And as I said, I'm with Classic Driver for over two decades now. So I have a lot of stories that I tell in conversations like this, I found in descriptions of cars for sale. And so that's very interesting. But coming back also to Villa d'Este, because we just put you as a part of our feature film, our 40-minute documentary, which is, by the way, live on our Classic Driver YouTube channel. I'm sure you watched it many, many times.
Oh, it's on repeat.
Yeah.
And thank you for grabbing me as I was walking through the bar to do that.
Now, the importance was to grab you before the event.
Whilst I still had some voice there.
Because your voice was still there. Because what people can't imagine, and I mean, I don't know how many words you speak, because you do it in two languages, sometimes three. So it's Italian, English, and sometimes French. And
I'd probably go over my word count if it's ever been calculated.
Yeah.
But it's about 4 hours each day.
Yeah.
Should be three and a half. But
yeah, but I mean, it's like...
But there's so much to say.
Yes, we don't want to miss out on this fantastic story, because actually that makes the cars.
And I know I'm repeating myself, but the cars, in my opinion, deserve it. The owners who spend a lot of money to own the cars and to bring them there and to enter them, I hope enjoy it.
Yeah.
And maybe most important of all, the public.
Yeah.
For whom it's sometimes a big financial sacrifice to go to a fancy event like that. And quite a long way to travel for some of them.
Yeah.
And I think they deserve a show. Hopefully they enjoy it. But
I'm sure they do.
But otherwise it's just a very nice beauty parade.
Yeah.
But it's like if I went to an art museum and walked around, I wouldn't have a clue regarding what I was looking at.
No.
If I had a guide, it makes the whole thing more relevant, and I remember it afterwards.
It's very important that the guide has to be entertaining. I don't need someone who reads out everything that they find on Wikipedia or that an AI agent.
Every guide, I think, is going to give it their own personality. Yeah. and we'll find different things interesting. We'll give it a different spin. And maybe the same guide on different days will tailor his or her description to their audience. And that's what in my own small way try to do.
I think it's a very important part of this, and I don't say this because I don't mean it. I mean it really because I really enjoy listening to this. Speaking about a Concours event, so we have big ones. So the big ones like Villa d'Este, Pebble Beach, or several others that also play a big role. I don't want to mention now every single one. Winning at these shows, is that also increase the value of a car or not?
I think if it's a sufficiently important show, like Pebble Beach or Villa d'Este, then arguably yes.
It's another story to tell, maybe.
Arguably. The more significant the car, the less important such a victory is. A little bit like period racing history.
Yeah.
A Mini that's won the Monte is worth a lot more than a standard car.
Absolutely right, yeah.
A Ferrari 250 GTO that won a significant race is worth, yes, a bit more than another GTO, but it's not a multiplier. It's a few percentage more. So if a Bugatti Atlantique wins Pebble Beach, does it help? Yes. Does it transform the value of the car? No. If a more humble car does so against all odds, then it has a bigger effect.
Yeah.
So I think it has some effect, but it's not perhaps as big as you would think.
I agree with this 100%, and I think it's just adding to the story. And you mentioned, like, if a 250 GTO won a non-significant race rather than a significant one, very famous one, you as someone who is in the trade.
In the trade.
Gosh, is it fair to say? I mean, you know,
sheepskin coat and flat cap ring about it, but yes, yeah. You're absolutely
right.
I mean,
sometimes that's my way. This is the only way I can pull your legs a little bit, because you are the impossible guy to really pull yourself out of the corner. So it's like, now, you being in the business of cars.
A used car dealer, yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you've been in the business of cars. Let's put it that way. Is it?
Now you make me sound like a modern BMW dealer.
Yeah, you know, the way, let's, used car dealer. You said used car dealer, I stick to that.
Yeah, no, that's
whatever,
fair.
You know what I mean. But let me come to the question, because it's very interesting. As someone who has contact with clients, do you think you feel immediately, and I'll come back to the comparison of the non-important race and the important race, or the well-known race, winning car, is it important to listen? Because they say, you know, I was in 1969. I was in this small race and I saw a Ferrari 250 short wheelbase racing there. Is that something you then recognize? Say, by the way, it didn't win the important race, but you can add some value to that one as well.
When you say that, are you talking about a potential buyer?
Yeah, potential buyer, sorry.
I've always, I suppose, being an incurable romantic and nostalgic.
Which is true, you are. You truly are.
That's one of the things that drives my passion for cars. To other people, it might be investment,
yeah,
whatever. I always love the chance to reunite somebody with something which they remember from their youth and that makes them happy, that gives them a good feeling. So if somebody says, I remember an ex when I was a kid, if they're, let's say, a normal person, I'd love to reunite them with it anyway. If they're a big car collector and they have the potential to actually own something like that, then of course I'm going to suggest that to them. And many people buy the cars that they remember from their youth, or at least they start out with those cars. They then may progress beyond that. But often that's the spark that starts the collecting journey. When I was a kid, I had my nose up against the showroom window and there was a new E-Type or a new Ferrari Daytona or F40 in there. And then hopefully after they've owned that, if they're lucky enough to do so, they'll say to themselves, okay, so this is a great car, but what came before it? What led to this? And then start to look into the back catalogue, learn more about the subject, and want to expand their knowledge and their collection.
Since 1998, Classic Driver is the place online to find iconic classics like an Aston Martin DB5 or modern sports cars like the latest Porsche GT3 RS. At Classic Driver, you find offerings from the most important dealers, the most trusted auction houses, but also from private sellers. So if you're thinking of buying a new car for your collection or selling, head over to Classic Driver.
Do you see a shift in your clients to the more younger side?
There is definitely a shift in the current market towards younger cars.
Yeah.
And that shift accelerated during COVID when buying anything online was attractive. People were bored, people were at home, and people were looking for ways to entertain themselves. And online auctions of cars in particular, in our world, accelerated a lot.
Yeah.
The cars that you can buy more easily online are younger cars.
True.
Because once you've got beyond the specification and the mileage, there's not that much else that you need to worry about. The older cars require more, I say, connoisseurship, or at least research, care, because there is good, but there is also bad. And therefore, that focused a lot of attention on the younger cars, which shot up in value during that period.
Incredibly, actually.
Incredibly so. There was obviously a lull afterwards, and that's now picked up for certain specific cars, limited edition Ferraris and Porsches in particular. And the so-called F cars, 288 GTO, F40, F50, and so on, in Ferrari terms, Porsche Carrera GT, Porsche 918, and others like them. Is that a permanent change? Is that a demographic change? Is it a generational change? Or is it a temporary fashion? I won't say fad, but let's say fashion. I think it's a bit of both.
Interesting.
I'm tempted to draw parallels with Nvidia and Bitcoin and other financial investments. And the old saying that the beanstalk can't grow to the sky. I don't think that the current price increases, I don't think many people would tell you that the rate of price increases in that segment of the market are sustainable. There are some cars at the moment which look glaringly obvious.
Value.
Lancia Aurelia Spider. One was sold in the auction in, I think, at Villaherba for €300,000 plus commission. May not be the best one in the world, but that is a model which in the past has sold for as much as $2 million at auction. It doesn't make sense that it's now that price.
I mean, a Ferrari short 250 short wheelbase is sold for the same amount like an Enzo.
That also does not make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
Now, an Enzo, as we all know, in an unusual color combination, was sold for, was it $17 million back in January? Another one in an unusual, but not quite as unusual, or maybe slightly higher mileage, was sold for 12, I think. Now, an Enzo is a perfectly nice car, don't get me wrong.
No, absolutely.
But is it a landmark car? Did it race? No. What is the rationale for that car being worth that money when you could buy a Ferrari short wheelbase, even a competition short wheelbase? There's the road version, there's the racing version, which was very successful, which was a landmark car, which was one of the cars that contributed to the Ferrari legend before the GTO.
Absolutely did.
How is it possible that we're even talking about those two models in the same breath? Now, some people are going to say, yes, but the short wheelbase is 60 years ago. Nobody remembers those cars when they were new. The Enzo is more relevant to the Bitcoin generation, and maybe it is. But who remembers a Bugatti Atlantique from when it was new? Nobody. You show that car to most people, they're going to still say,
"Yes,
wow, that is a work of art." If they hear it start up, they're going to say, "Wow, that sounds really good."
Yes.
If they drive it, they're not going to be impassive. It is going to move them literally and emotionally. So I don't think you have to have been alive when a car was, I don't remember the Miura when I was young. I was a baby. So I don't think that you can simplify to that extent and just say that people are buying the cars from their youth and that will keep on changing. By that logic, one day nobody's going to want a Ferrari F40 because there's going to be a day when nobody remembers an F40 or an Enzo. So I don't think you can simplify it that much. I always come back to the rule of intrinsic value over financial value. Intrinsic value, which is the real value, which does not necessarily change with time. The financial value does. Mm. Anybody who tells you that, oh, it's only going to go up in value, they're either selling it to you or they're naive. Intrinsic value is the rarity, but it's also the aesthetics. It's the engineering, the sophistication of the engineering. It is how superior that object was, not just cars, to the opposition when it came out.
That's a very important
point.
That
is a mark of greatness.
Yes.
Like a gullwing Mercedes or a Ferrari GTO, countless other cars that we could, McLaren F1. And also, which I think we'll probably come back to later, who bought it? Was it bought by the right people?
Mm-hmm.
Was it bought for the right reasons?
Good point. I've never looked at that point.
When you think of owning a car, you're often going to look at who else owns it, what type of person owns it, and do you want to be part of that group? Can I say, I might make myself unpopular, that held back Veyrons for a long time.
I disagree.
For a long time.
Yeah, I disagree.
I'm not saying necessarily now.
I mean, I knew you also knew some of the new clients of who bought new Veyron from Bugatti.
Some
I would agree. Some I would agree. But I mean, there's like flamboyant name like Arnold Schwarzenegger and others, right? Don't forget that.
Arnold Schwarzenegger is cool. There's no question. Yeah. I'm thinking some of the people that you see outside well-known department stores making themselves unpopular. And some of the specs think to yourself, really?
Yeah, in that extent, I think it's a very like, they took the liberty of the freedom of expression quite to their heart in some of the specs.
Just because you can do something doesn't always mean you should do it.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And you probably want to talk about this model of car, the McLaren F1.
Yes.
Look at who bought that car from the very outset.
And look at the specs.
And most of them, not entirely.
I think there's
almost all.
Which one is the one?
I'm not going to say, but there are one or two that you have to
say, please.
No, there are one or two, only one or two that did come into the can do rather than should do category.
I try to recall which car you mean. There are now two. If you don't say it, there are two ways. You just acknowledge my bad taste because I don't know, I couldn't recall those cars. Or it's so awful that you really don't want to share it.
No, it's not that awful. I've seen a lot worse with other brands.
Okay.
But look at who bought those cars. Yes. Ralph Lauren, Nick Mason, Jay Leno, all people, Thomas Pesher, all people who others look up to for their car collecting taste and credentials.
Yeah.
And also, I think that's really important, people who are known to have bought that car for what it is rather than speculation.
But when I remember correctly, it was also not an easy sell. If we speak to David Clark,
exactly.
It was a tough one.
You did not buy that car for speculation.
No.
You bought it at the worst possible time in the world economy.
We have to mention George Harrison, by the way.
George Harrison, absolutely. Almost certainly expecting that it was going to go down in value, which it did massively for a long time. It was worth half of its new price when it was just a few years old.
And look at the trend it did, the journey it did.
But who knew? And that's what's really important. When you bought that car, you were taking a leap of faith. You weren't doing it for speculation. Mm. And I think that's really important. It gives credibility to the object and to the people who bought it.
this point, I'm 100% with you, and I'm surprised that I was not following this kind of logic also in my way of thinking about what is the reason why some cars get a perfect nimbus, a perfect view from the outside world. And that's a very, very important part. And we have to say, there's also another very famous owner of an F1, Simon Kidston.
I was a very late comer to that party.
Yeah.
I remember that car when it came out. David Clark took me for a drive-in one. I was just a young salesman.
So we have to say
David Clark is the former salesman headset. I suppose you'd probably say commercial director.
Commercial director.
Of McLaren,
yes.
Back in the F1 yes. road car era. And he was the man responsible for selling them.
Yeah.
Not an easy task when it was £600,000.
Yeah, something like this.
And the world economy was still largely in free fall. Interest rates in the UK were 15%.
Everything was tanking. It was really like crazy.
That was not an easy sell. But David is a very, very persuasive man and a very well-connected one. He turned up to see my boss in the demonstrator, which he was using to show around. At the end of the meeting with my boss, to which I was not invited, I said, oh, David, could I... First name terms, quite old for a... But I was a salesman.
Of course.
A 23-year-old or whatever. And I think I could get a ride. Just go around the block. And I and a colleague, Vanessa, both got a ride in this car. First gear, second gear, third gear, fourth gear. No accelerator. Just lift up the clutch, no throttle. Mm. Away it went. Second, third, fourth. That was the party trick. And then floor it.
Yeah.
And it just took off like a scalded cat. And I've mentioned this before, that all the builders on the scaffolding of the on the road that we were on Gloucester Road all turned around open mouthed to think, what was that? And I thought, that's pretty cool.
It is.
And it just stuck with me. And then years and years later, when I was doing a documentary, a friend lent me his GTR. I couldn't drive it because of insurance. Only his own driver could. I was in the passenger seat. And I could not believe how intense it was. It was in the Middle East.
Yeah,
and we passed a poor cyclist about that far away, and I watched him wobbling in the rearview mirror. I hate to think what speed we were doing, but there was a cloud of dust behind us, and I came back on the flight that night thinking, I have to have one of those cars one day, even though no way I could afford it. So it took a few more years.
But you have a good track record of the cars that you want to have to get them. Miura, you see?
That's
the emotional Simon.
When I get something into my head, I won't normally give up.
And if I remember correctly, say if it's wrong, but your F1 had a fantastic chassis number, wasn't it?
007.
Here we go. I mean, did you bought it for that reason, or was it just really pure coincidence?
Nostalgia. I had sold it for the first owner
as a
young auctioneer. £350,000, by the way.
Plus premium.
Only one bidder. Only one bidder in the room.
That was a tough sale then as well.
September 98.
Yeah.
Paris. He drove down from Yorkshire in his M5 BMW, owned the nightclub, placed the sole winning bid, and drove home a happy man.
Yeah.
He's still a friend now, all these years later. And he's had some great other cars, by the way, including an F1 GTR. But anyways, it's a long list of cool things that he's had. So I'd sold it when I was young. Chassis 007. Black, like my Miura. Good spec. Road car. No high downforce kit. Elegant. Subtle. Just the way, personally, I like it to be. So, yeah, that was the one... If I could get it, that I wanted. And I couldn't get it. I didn't know who owned it years later. So I managed, again, I didn't really deserve it, but I managed to buy another one from a friend, remortgaged my house, gave him my first gullwing in part exchange, somehow made the ends meet. Went to collect the car at McLaren. Happiest man in the world.
Yeah.
The dream come true, except that what's behind it, chassis 007.
Done. Perfect.
Perfection turns to almost perfection.
Yeah.
I think, wow, Who knows who owns it? It's not for sale. It wasn't meant to be. The next day I'm in the office. It's late. Somebody calls. May I speak to Simon Kidston? Yeah. I'm told you're the man to speak to about McLaren F1s. I have one I'd like to sell. I said, oh, which one is it? It's black. It's chassis 007.
Just one day after?
Ping! 1 or 2 days
after. Really?
I'd already bought this car.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll sell it for you happily. First person I call up, big collector, Ferrari GTO, lots of other nice things. Yeah, Simon, I don't really feel that I need to own a McLaren F1, but...
what a sentence is that?
I won't tell you the accent, otherwise you'll know who it was, but he's a great negotiator. That's why he has a Tiffany GTO.
Yeah.
And, but even if I did have one, I don't like black cars. Maybe a silver one. Uh-huh. Let me come back to you. So a bit of creative thinking later. He had a silver F1 and I had a black one. And that lasted for 10 years.
Yeah.
Great, great, great memories.
Some things are meant to be. That's the secret.
Or you just have to make them, you just have to make them happen and think out of the box.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think it's good to say that this is one of your superpowers, thinking outside of the box.
I think it's, I hate to sound cliched, but I think it all comes back down to passion. If you love something enough, sure. And if you want something enough,
absolutely,
somehow you will figure out a way to make it happen.
And you made also something very incredible happen. At least you were part of it. Because for the longest time being, a Ferrari 250 GTO was the most expensive car ever sold. That changed. And my Germanic side is absolutely proud of this. This changed because...
German honor was restored.
Yeah. It was never de-restored. It was just partially given away to have others also enjoying it at a good time. You know how we Germans are. We are very open and are caring about others. let me face. So you were part of the change of custodianship. I think that sounds very elegant.
That's a very good choice of words.
Of the Uhlenhaut. Tell us more about that, the 300 SLR. So first of all, tell us more about the car.
Mythical car. Handful built, purely for racing, by Mercedes, with typical Teutonic single-mindedness, no expense spared, all the company's engineering might thrown at it, and the result was a car that completely dominated racing during the only season in which it competed, 1955.
It's crazy.
Won everything except for Le Mans, from which it retired after a tragic accident involving another car, another Mercedes, whilst leading the race. And despite that, it won the world championship. Mercedes withdrew from racing with nothing left to prove, and the surviving cars were put into the museum, never, ever, ever to be sold.
Yes.
Pretty much the most dominant racing car, or certainly sports racing car.
I would say so.
Apart from Grand Prix cars.
Also, in terms of development, so many things that we saw in later racing, absolutely...
Years ahead of its time.
Years ahead.
As we said before, head and shoulders above the opposition, the true mark of a classic. The cars go into the museum. Some of them are loaned to other museums, but none is ever sold despite many approaches. And that's not a short-term decision. That's a forever policy. One of these cars will never be sold. They are our crown jewels. The open cars, which raced, and the two gullwing coupe closed cars that were built to be raced, but that never were. The intended for the Carrera Panamericana, the high-speed South American race.
So very hence, close to netted. To
hence more aerodynamic, hence the closed body.
And very close connected to a genius engineering name.
The two closed cars were occasionally used by Rudi Uhlenhaut, the chief engineer of the project, as his so-called company cars. Having been lucky enough to drive one of them, it increases my respect for him, not just as an engineer, but as a driver. It's not an unintimidating car to drive on the road. The clutch, the gear change, and above all, the noise. And there's an awful lot of it, especially in the closed car.
I mean, that's the reason why he needed to push the car out of his driveway, because the neighbors, when he left tomorrow, going in the morning, I think direction Sindelfingen, he had to push it a bit away because he had some very typical German, very like arguments with his neighbors about the noise of the car. That's the hearsay.
Can you imagine this modest suburban German house back in the 50s with a 300 SLR sitting outside it?
Yeah.
If anybody had told them that one day... day that car would have been worth, which presumably was the value of the entire street, they would have scoffed.
Of course.
And they certainly wouldn't have left the car outside.
No.
But for those reasons, that model of car acquired this mythical unicorn status amongst car enthusiasts and collectors, because you just couldn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
It had won everything. It looked like... really nothing else. If you put that next to a normal Gullwing, the closed car, it the doors open upwards and it's got four wheels, but that's pretty much where the similarities end. Just look at the length of the bonnet, eight cylinders versus six, the stubby exhausts with blackened tips out the side. You know before it even starts, this is not going to be a quiet car. The details on it, everything, it's just typical Mercedes attention to detail and efficiency. So... I'm sure I'm not the only person that thought that was the ultimate. Also because of its unobtainability.
Yeah.
And this is a view that's been held for many, many years. If you look at some articles, even from the 50s, Rob Walker, famous British gentleman driver and team owner, went to the factory, big Mercedes client, bought, I think, three Gullwings and a Roadster. I politely inquired, he wrote in his column in Motorsport, with the director, if a 300 SLR might be available. Absolutely not, came the reply, although probably in politer German terms. So, fast forward many, many years, I'd seen a 300 SLR on the retrospective Mille Miglia with my dad, was struck by the noise, the presence as this thing went by, gobbling up every other little red car in its path. What was that? Oh, that was the 300 SLR. And it was driven by Stirling Moss, who was reprising his old route in his old car with his old co-driver. When I went to the Mercedes Museum, I would go and see that car. I would buy any books that came out on it, and there weren't very many. And then over the years, you meet people and acquire clients and friends. And one of these friends, clients, said to me, casually chatting as you do with friends, not thinking it will ever lead to anything. You've always said, Simon, that the 300 SLR is probably the greatest car in the world in collecting terms, and that it'll never be sold. But what have we got to lose by trying?
Yeah.
I must admit, I did not expect him to say that. Came as a surprise. But this is somebody who I respect a great deal. Somebody quite softly spoken, but I know that when he says something, he means it. It's bulletproof.
Yeah.
Not many other people I would have listened to and acted upon that question, mm-hmm. and that statement. Fast forward a while, and I was invited to the Mercedes-Benz factory boardroom, asked to present a case. And a few months later, I was informed that there would be a private auction, that a maximum of 10 bidders would be invited from around the world, and that if I would like to attend to represent my client, they would be very pleased.
Yeah. So there was, who was the auction house? Arm Sotheby's, or who was involved in that?
Don't ask me to say that, please. Okay. It was a well-known auction house.
It was a well-known auction house.
It was a well-known auction house, with whom I have a good relationship.
Yeah.
But for compliance reasons, Mercedes needed of to course. Hold, albeit a very small one,
yeah.
but nonetheless an auction yeah. to determine what the fair market price would be. And yeah, that was one of the most memorable days of my life.
I could imagine.
Adrenaline, emotion, disbelief.
Can you tell us about the setting, or is it too completely confidential? Like, how do you have your is there an auctioneer who opens envelopes, or
there's a private room at the Mercedes-Benz Museum? I turn up, I drive to the Mercedes Museum in my Gullwing,
obviously
my father's Gullwing.
Yes.
I just thought that was a nice historical symmetry. It would have been much more comfortable to drive there in a modern yeah. car, but this is a really special day. So I drove there in the Gullwing. Was told that the museum was closed for a private event. Yeah. Sorry, come back again yeah. tomorrow. I said, no, I'm here yeah. for that event. Oh, you'll have to go to the public car park. Yeah. Drove all the way around to the public car park. Collected my parking ticket.
Which you have to pay for, obviously.
Yes, €5. I've still got the receipt. Yeah.
Good.
Went into the museum, where finally somebody from Mercedes did meet me and whisk me off to a private room. And then at the designated time was invited to go through these cement or concrete back corridors, yeah. Very industrial. It's like going onto the stage at a concert and going through the backstage first. And clink, clonk downstairs, doors open, fire escape. And then black door opens and there's this great big, I think, circular room. I wasn't allowed to take any photographs. There is the silhouette of a car under a cover. There is an auctioneer's podium, rostrum, next to it. There are some small load tables like this, I think four of them, with three chairs around yep. each one, rather than the conventional rows yep. of seating. So you already know it. This is going to be a very small auction. And a what I would describe as a barrage of telephones on a long table against one wall. And you sort of know that's going to be your opposition. The tables are empty. I go and choose one and sit down at it. And I should add that I had received not long before a contract about that thick as to the bidding terms, which were rather more onerous than most auctions. So that took an awful long time, together with a German lawyer, to go through. The room is largely empty. One by one, people file in and start to occupy the telephones. Eventually, the auctioneer walks in, calls the room to order with his gavel. There's yeah. been nobody there to call to order.
So you were the
I'm
only
the
one.
I'm the only person that's turned up in person to represent a bidder or to bid on yep. this car. The auctioneer invites the head of Mercedes, the Mercedes-Benz Museum, to make a speech, which he does, and tells us what the car is. Thank you. There's a video. Very nice. The cover is whisked off the car, and the bidding starts. I think it was at €50 million, which mm-hmm. would already be an auction record. The auction yep. record, I think, at the time was $49.5 million for a Ferrari GTO.
Yes.
Set, I believe, in 2018 from memory. And bidding starts. Now, I don't want to give away sort of too many secrets, but
do.
Every bidder has their opinion as to the best way to bid. And I'm not sure that there is any, honestly, yep. any best way. But as an ex-auctioneer, you probably have a little bit more insight than the average person. Some people like to get in early to let the auctioneer know that they're interested and so that he keeps an eye open on them for them. Others prefer to wait until the very, very last minute. In this instance, I figured that he knew that if I was there, and given that there was nobody else there, I was, or at least, sorry, the client, most importantly, that I was representing, was interested. Bidding kicks off, 50, 55, 60, you know, pretty punchy, increments that would buy a very, very nice car on their own. A 100 is reached. That's pretty serious territory.
Yeah, here we go.
I mean, you're now at double the world record, the world auction record for a car. You're at more than has ever been paid for a car before. The record, nobody knows exactly what the private sale record was at the time, but it was probably about 70 million euros, $78 million for a very good Ferrari 250 GTO.
Yes.
In a private sale.
Yeah.
So you really are in uncharted territory.
Yeah.
This is big player stuff. And you really have to stay calm and rational.
Play cool.
Not just play cool, but remain rational and think to yourself, I'm representing a client. This is not my money. It's a huge amount of money. What is the right thing to do?
Yeah. Do you get briefed beforehand? So do you have like a outline range where you can go, agreed with the client?
Loosely.
Okay. Very dangerous grounds on these numbers, I would say.
It's a big responsibility. It's a very big responsibility.
Yeah, my hands start sweating now already.
Very, more loosely than one might expect. There's a lot of mutual trust there. I said before, I wouldn't do this for many people.
Sure.
The bidders start to thin out. I'm listening carefully to the telephone bidders who aren't that far away from me to hear what language they're speaking. And I won't betray that confidence. Until finally there's just one left. And we're still in the running. And we're up there. But this is the first time in history that a Mercedes-Benz 300 SLR has been sold. And it's one of the two Uhlenhaut coupes, which aesthetically, it's a personal thing, I think are even more attractive than the open cars. I've often said that is the Mona Lisa of cars for that reason. Most objects have been sold before. There is some comparable, either that object or a similar one to it. You can decide to pay double or three times or four times or exactly the same as what it's sold for before or less.
Yeah.
But you have some basis. Here you have no frame of reference, none. It's the first time one of these cars has ever been sold. It's probably in our lifetimes the only one, the only time one is going to be sold. Somebody else is willing to pay $5 million less, $2 million less, $3 million less. Those were the increments by that stage.
Wow.
You'd go up 120, 122, 125, 128, 130. 132, his bid, and straight back at him, 135 our bid. A little bit to let him know that we still had gas in the tank.
Yeah.
To use a popular expression. And I could tell that the other person was, I'm sure financially still able. But mentally.
For sure.
Mentally, I think he was, at that moment on that day, he was out.
I give it a pass.
And, I did go to the auctioneer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Get a bloody move on, excuse my language, to drop the hammer. I've been there not just for half an hour, but for a year and a half.
Yeah.
That's how long we've been discussing it. And the hammer dropped and mission accomplished.
Deal done. As you said, mission accomplished. Were you relieved? Was there a feeling of relief that you say, okay, I could?
Huge relief. Emotion, because this is an unrepeatable moment. Records get broken. And I think that record will one day be broken.
Maybe, yeah.
But it won't be by a greater car than that. It will just be the market catching up.
Apologies for the next question, but I think it's very interesting to understand that. How did that sale change your ego? Or did it whatsoever? Or did it not change anything?
I think my friends probably accuse me, probably rightfully so, of having a big ego in the first place.
Hasn't changed.
Still as overblown as ever.
Yeah. this is a real, an accomplishment in life for sure. And also, I couldn't think of someone that is your client to get the custodian of this significant, historically significant and highly emotional car in the automotive universe. Are there any conditions for the sale in terms of what you can do and what you can't do with that?
Yeah, the conditions, I think, are probably confidential. But given that this was and is, because they have the sister car, obviously, in the museum, the sole surviving Uhlenhaut Coupe. Sole other surviving Uhlenhaut Coupe. There are restrictions on what you can do with it in terms of who maintains it. But I think conditions that you understand when you realize the significance of that car to Mercedes. They described it as parting with one of their children.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I mentioned that there was a thick contract. There was.
Yeah.
The criteria for being allowed to bid on that car, and I don't know exactly, I don't know all of those criteria.
Yeah.
But when they said a maximum of 10 people around the world, that tells you that the criteria were quite strict. It's a huge amount of money, but there are obviously more than 10 people around the world, in the world, who could afford to spend that on something, whether it's a work of art or something that floats or a car. So that shows you that Mercedes were very selective about who they allowed to bid on that car.
So this is the Holy Grail. Apologies for that analogy, but it is the Holy Grail for you. But still, in your personal life, in your personal auto life, is there a car that you said, I need to have this one in my life and I'm looking for it or chasing it for a long, long time, but I have not achieved that goal?
If you didn't have those goals, you wouldn't have the dreams to chase.
Yeah.
A collection that becomes static, and I would say that because I sell them cars, but that becomes static and never buys or sells another car really starts to die.
Yeah, true.
Needs to evolve, needs to keep developing, keep improving.
Yeah.
And the same, I think, is true of any car enthusiast, myself included. There's always got to be something to chase. There's always got to be a dream. The Miura always was, to me, a dream. And I've had mine now for nearly 30 years.
Yeah.
And I love it as much as I did when I first got it. And I still get butterflies before a special drive, a long drive in it. The Carrera RS, which I had my dad had as a kid, is the car I would never sell because it's the one car that he kept and that I inherited. So it's been in the family for over 50 years.
Yeah, I didn't know
and
that.
And it's a great car to drive.
It is.
It is a fantastic, fantastic all-round car to drive. It's German. It works. There's a reason most cars are collectible. And it started out when they were just used cars.
Yeah.
But people who loved cars said to each other, have you tried one of those? You really should. And the word spread, and over time, values increase. And the same thing, by the way, about the Ferrari GTO, 250 GTO, the proper GTO.
Yeah.
people focus so much on the value of that car, and it's a calling card and so on. But leave all that aside. If you get the opportunity to drive one of those cars, and you've got, plenty of owners, take that opportunity.
Yeah.
Forget the value if you can. And if it gets bent, very expensive metal doesn't need to cost a lot more than a more humble car to fix. And they've all been crashed at some stage in their lives because they were racing cars. Then you realize why people started collecting those cars when they were just used racing cars. Now, I'll never be able to afford a 250 GTO. That is something I would love to own. And if I did, I would drive it all the time, everywhere. No excuses, because it's just such a feel-good car when you're sitting in that seat. The bulge of the carburetors, of the wings, of the air scoops, of the leather straps, of the chrome clips, the bare dashboard, of which there is very little, the beautiful thin-rimmed wooden wheel, the tall metallic and usually heated gear lever and an aluminium gear knob, the reverberation inside the car. Sorry, I'm going on a bit here. Turn the key, hear the click, click, click of the fuel pumps, push it in this eruption of sound.
Yes.
Ah, that car makes you feel good to drive. It just makes you feel good about life. So a GTO would be lovely, but I don't think I'll ever be able to afford one. And then on a completely left of field level, purely romance, not the driving experience, I've never sold and certainly not owned a Bugatti Royale. And when I was a kid, believe it or not, or a teenager, that was my dream car. It was just so overblown. As you could say, it's a Lamborghini Countach of its era in a way, although serving a completely different purpose.
Absolutely.
It is so much more than you would ever need. The Countach in terms of performance and styling back in the day, and many years earlier, 40 years earlier, more than 40 years earlier, the Royale, longer, bigger, more powerful. It's a car that would suit you.
Thank you very much.
It is...
I feel this is, it's true.
Herculean in its proportions. Steering wheel the size of a bus. Four horns, by the way, one on every spoke. This huge, great bus-like gear change, three gears, I think. 12.7-liter engine, if I remember correctly. Fun to drive.
Arguably.
Debatable. But as a statement of what human intent can do, whether it's needed or not is academic. The fact that it's not makes it even more remarkable. Doing something just because it's a challenge, rather than because it's because it's necessary. So a Bugatti Royale, at the least, I would love to handle once in my career. That's the a box that remains to be ticked. I don't think I'll ever probably own one. Would it might make financial sense? I think we both know the answer to that. But then again, everything should not be financially rationalized.
I think that's very nice closing words, I have to say. Even though it's, there are wonderful words to close our little classic driver conversation here. And because we shall not forget, and you said it at the beginning, we shall not forget that cars are made by people. People spend their most valuable asset they have, their lifetime, in creating them, in building them, in make them perfect and bring them back to a perfect shape. And that's absolutely, there's no value you can put on that. However, before the investment, it is important that you make sure that you have a car or buy a car that you have a good time with, because if the investment doesn't work, another very, very great investment in your personal life has been completed by having a good time with whatever car it is. And with this, I would like to thank you, Simon, that you joined us in our Classic Driver Garage studio and took us on this amazing journey of the black and white TV near Siena on a farmhouse to
watching
a dark... Watching the Persuaders in Italian to a dark room in somewhere in Mercedes-Benz, making the winning bid for the most expensive motor car ever sold. I think this completes also a bit the impression of your life in the fullest.
Well, thankfully, we haven't talked about EasyJet, which is where I spend a lot of my life. But I think if I can come back to you on what you just said, money comes and goes, and most of us know that it goes more easily than it arrives. What are you going to spend it on? The memories are what
Yes.
What stay? And if you own a car purely as an investment, you're not getting value for money.
Absolutely right.
You could probably make a lot more money, maybe lose a lot more money with Bitcoin or Nvidia. Cars were built to be enjoyed. This is called classic driver, not classic investor, for a reason.
True.
And if you don't get behind the wheel and find out what it will do and make memories for you and your family and your friends and pass that on to the next generation, then you're missing the point.
Definitely. Thank you all for joining us on this, as I said, incredible journey in the automotive universe with Simon Kitson here at Classic Driver Talks. And if you liked what you saw, please do us a favor and subscribe to our YouTube channel to never miss one of the future episodes of our little podcast. And of course, not any one of our cool films that we'll be producing for you in the future. And also to be up to date of a daily Classic Driver life, follow us on our social medias and you will not miss anything out of this wonderful world of automotive. And for me, it's just to say thank you again, Simon Kitson, for joining us at today's episode.
Thank you, JP, and let's hope you can get the coffee machine working now.
Don't mention the coffee machine.